Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Well, later in the show, I shall atone for my remiss last week. I never got time to do my little quiz that I was going to ask you on. Should you retire? 10 questions to help you decide. We will do that later. But I'm even more excited about topic one. You know, when I look back on what changes people's behavior, we've seen many, many massive government and nonprofit and for-profit initiatives to try to improve humankind. And often the big evaluation reports show, let's just say, they're disappointing. And yet sometimes I wonder whether we've, not just do I wonder, but I think about some very, what would be described as simplistic initiatives that may have made a bigger difference and certainly offered a lot more bang for the buck. And the one that comes to mind is the bumper sticker, let's do random acts of kindness or unrandom acts of kindness. It's just a good reminder. That's a soundbite. You can keep it in your head and it feels right. And I suspect a lot of people, whether it be, you know, when you see a bumper sticker, sticking an extra quarter in somebody's meter is just expired when the meter maid's about to come and ticket you. It's a little random acts of kindness, perhaps better in that person's pocket than in the government's. So I did some thinking in preparation for this week's show about what are some of the simpler ways to try to engender real change in people regarding their work life, which is, of course, the focus of the show. And it struck me that children's books are a particularly good example. Not all of them. Some of them are just designed to make you laugh. But there are some children's picture books that do indeed have messages for adults. They're simple. They're memorable. And it starts, believe it or not, with something as simple as The Cat in the Hat. The, you know, kind of book number one. Which actually, and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to read about seven of these or six of these, something like that. And we'll hopefully discuss a little bit about the lessons that may be embedded. And I guess I do want to start with The Cat in the Hat because it's actually quite a subversive little story. Of course, wouldn't you know, I can't find it. Give me a moment. It will be here, I promise. There we go. Okay. What is the message of this book, The Cat in the Hat, in case you're not familiar? It may have been 60 years since you've heard it. But it is quite subversive, actually. Its message is, when you break a rule, as long as no significant harm accrues, consider covering your tracks and lying about it. The story is about a cat that visits two kids when mom is away, and he creates all kinds of mayhem, fun mayhem. And when the kids and the cat hear that mom's returning, the cat quickly cleans up and leaves. The mom returns and asks the kids, well, what did you do while we were gone, while I was gone? Well, the book ends by asking the reader, what would you say if your mother asked you? And the question for adults is, when is it and isn't it worth breaking the rules? When is it worth covering up? Watergate, Libya, Benghazi, small things we do at work, big things we do at work. So now, partly for the fun of it and partly to stimulate the conversation, I shall now read you The Cat in the Hat. The sun did not shine. It was too wet to play. So we sat in the house all that cold, cold, wet day. I sat there with Sally. We sat there, we two, and I said, how I wish we had something to do. Too wet to go out, and too cold to play ball. So we sat in the house, we did nothing at all. So all we could do was to sit, 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 sit. And we did not like it, not one little bit. And then something went bump. How that bump made us jump. We looked. Then we saw him step in on the mat. We looked and we saw him, the Cat in the Hat. And he said to us, why do you sit there like that? I know it is wet and the sun is not sunny, but we can have lots of good fun that is funny. I know some good games we could play, said the cat.
I know some new tricks, said the Cat in the Hat. A lot of good tricks. I will show them to you. Your mother will not mind at all if I do.
Then Sally and I did not know what to say. Our mother was out of the house for the day. But our fish said, No, no, make that cat go away. Tell that Cat in the Hat you do not want to play. He should not be here. He should not be about. He should not be here while your mother is out.
Now, now, have no fear. Have no fear, said the cat. My tricks are not bad, said the Cat in the Hat. Why, we can have lots of good fun if you wish with a game that I call Up, Up, Up with a Fish. Put me down, said the fish. This is no fun at all. Put me down, said the fish. I do not wish to fall. Have no fear, said the cat. I will not let you fall. I will hold you up high as I stand on a ball, with a book on one hand and a cup on my hat. Ah, but that is not all I can do, said the cat. Look at me now, said the cat. With a cup and a cake on top of my hat, I can hold up two books. I can hold up the fish and a little toy ship and some milk on a dish. And look, I can hop up and down on the ball. Oh, but that's not all. Oh, no, that's not all. Look at me now. It is fun to have fun, but you have to know how. I can hold up the cup and the milk and the cake. I can hold up these books and the fish on a rake. I can hold the toy ship and a little toy man. And look, with my tail, I can hold a red fan. I can fan with the fan as I hop on the ball. But that is not all. Oh, that is not all.
That's what the cat said. Then he fell on his head. He came down with a bump from up there on the ball, and Sally and I, we saw all the things fall. And our fish came down, too. He fell into a pot. He said, Do I like this? No, I do not. This is not a good game, said our fish as he lit. No, I do not like it, not one little bit.
Now look what you did, said the fish to the cat. Now look at this house, look this and that. You sank our toy ship and sank it deep in the cake. You shook up our house and you bent our new rake. You should not be here when our mother is out. You get out of this house, said the fish in the pot.
But I like to be here. Oh, I like it a lot, said the Cat in the Hat to the fish in the pot. I will not go away. I do not wish to go.
And so, said the Cat in the Hat,
so. I will show you another good game that I know.
And then he ran out. And then, fast as a fox, the Cat in the Hat came back in with a box, a big red wood box. It was shut with a hook. Now look at this trick, said the cat. Take a look. And then he got up on top with the tip of his hat.
I call this game Fun in a Box, said the cat.
In this box are two things I will now show you. Now, you will like these two things, said the cat in a bow. I will pick up the hook, and you will see something new, two things, and I call them Thing One and Thing Two. These things, I'm actually going to skip ahead because there's something, you know, this is not exactly, I'm always obsessed with time effectiveness for you guys. So much as I would enjoy reading the rest of this, I'm going to get back to the back. So in the end, he cleans up with his, quote, thing one and thing two, these little assistants. And then we reach the end. The mother says, And then who is back in the house? Why, the cat. Have no fear of this mess, said the Cat in the Hat. I always pick up all my playthings, and so I will show you another good trick that I do. Then we saw him pick up all the things that were down. He picked up the cake and the rake and the gown and the milk and the strings and the book and the dish and the fan and the cup and the ship and the fish, and he put them away, and then he said, That's that. And then he was gone with a tip of his hat. Then our mother came in. And she said to us too, Did you have any fun? Tell me, what did you do? And Sally and I did not know what to say. Should we tell her the things that went on there that day? Should we tell her about it? Now, what should we do? Well, what would you do if your mother asked you? And that is the end of the Cat in the Hat. And so now, it's a good time for me to give out the phone number. It really is a question about when is it appropriate to lie and to cover up. And because this show focuses on work, and, you know, candidly, in almost every workplace there is lying. There is a study that shows that people lie 10 times a day. Now, most of them are white lies to help save people's feelings or whatever. But, you know, unfortunately, the simplistic George Washington never lie ends up in the real world requiring more nuance than that. So I invite you to call in if you have a dilemma, especially one where you're wondering whether you should lie, whether you should cover up something that happened at work. Should you be a whistleblower? Should you admit you screwed up when you screwed up maybe even something as dishonest as padding your expense account? Should you, or is it the corporate organization is a pig and we need to redistribute the wealth from the 90, from the 1% to the 99 or so? I will screw that company as much as I can. Or is it a cosmic injustice? I welcome your call about your dilemma about when it is and isn't appropriate to lie in the workplace. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now while we're waiting for the calls, I'm going to move into another story. And this one has quite an emotional appeal to me, because I read it so many times to my daughter, Amy, who's now quite an adult. But for some reason, it has stood the test of time. While I read her thousands of stories, that's a lie, probably hundreds of stories, she loved them repeated. I would read the same story again and again. Again, Daddy! Again, Daddy! Which gave me great pleasure, because I noticed what was happening was that before she was learning to read by watching, she would apprehend ever more of the words. And it was really that repetition was key to her learning to read. So I may have read the story about Ping, I would honestly guess between Barbara and me, my wife, probably 100 times, maybe 50. But in any case, it is a beautiful story with a lesson. It's about a duckling who'd be coming home late. He would thus get a swat. He got distracted. So he missed being with his family. His family kind of went off back to the home, back to their home, and he was stranded out. Anyway, he was afraid of the punishment, and so he stayed out and didn't come. He, faced the punishment of being late, and he almost ended up getting eaten by people or getting enslaved. Finally, he decided to return home and accept the punishment. I'm certainly against corporal punishment, and the book does give him a swat. In the book, he does get a swat. But the book does make us think about whether and when to accept our actions' consequences, a similar issue as it pertained to, as was applied to the Cat in the Hat before. Over my life, but it's not quite the same, because over my lifetime, I really have noticed an increase in people, because they want to avoid their consequences. They blame other people or the system for their failings. So the embedded question that's career-related in the story about Ping is, how much do you take responsibility for your screw-ups? Do you unfairly externalize responsibility to a coworker, to the system, to some attribute, some group that you're a part of, whether it be by age, race, gender, sexual orientation, whatever, when that really is not what's primarily operative? That's the question. And now, for fun as much as anything else, I'm going to at least start and hopefully maybe finish, if it feels like it's not a waste of your time, the story about Ping. Once upon a time, there was a beautiful young duck named Ping. Ping lived with his mother and his father and two sisters and three brothers and 11 aunts and 7 uncles and 42 cousins. Their home was a boat with two wise eyes on the Yangtze River. Each morning as the sun rose from the east, Ping and his mother and his father and two sisters and three brothers and 11 aunts and 7 uncles and 42 cousins all marched one by one down a little bridge to the shore of the Yangtze River. Note, by the way, the subtle, embracing of the notion of family, including extended family, staying together. Something that is part of some cultures and not so much here in America. All day, they would hunt for snails and little fishes and other pleasant things to eat. But in the evening, as the sun set in the west, "La la 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 lay," would call the master of the boat. Quickly, Ping and all his family would come scurrying quickly, and they'd march one by one up over the little bridge and onto the wise-eyed boat, which was their home on the Yangtze River. Ping was always careful, very, very careful, not to be the last, because the last duck to cross the bridge always got a spank on the back. But one afternoon, as the shadows grew long, Ping did not hear the call, because at the moment Ping was wrong side up, he was trying to catch a little fish, and so he didn't hear. By the time Ping was right side up, his mother and his father and his aunts were already marching one by one over the bridge. By the time Ping neared the shore, his uncles and his cousins were marching over, and by the time Ping reached the shore, the last of his 42 cousins had crossed the bridge. Ping knew he'd be last, the very last duck, if he crossed the bridge, and Ping did not want to be spanked, so he hid. Ping hid behind the grasses, and as the dark came and the pale moon shone in the sky, Ping watched the wise-eyed boat slowly sail down the Yangtze River. All night long, Ping slept near the grasses on the bank of the river with his head tucked under his wing. There was no father or mother, no sisters or brothers, no aunts or uncles, and no 42 cousins to go fishing with Ping. So Ping started to find them, swimming down the yellow waters of the Yangtze River. As the sun rose higher, boats came. Big boats and little boats, fishing boats and beggars' boats, houseboats and raft boats, all these boats had eyes to see, but with nowhere. Unfortunately, that line's cut off. Then came a boat full of strange, dark fishing birds. Ping saw them diving for fish for their master. As each bird brought a fish to his master, he would give it a little piece of fish for pay. Closer and closer swooped the fishing birds near Ping. Now Ping could see shining rings around their necks, rings of metal made so tight the birds could never swallow the big fish they were catching. When Ping came up to the top of the water, far away from the fishing birds, he found little crumbs floating, tender little rice cake crumbs, which made a path to the houseboat. As Ping ate these crumbs, he came nearer and nearer to the houseboat. But then, splash! There in the water was a boy, a little boy with a barrel on his back, which was tied to a rope from the boat, as all boat boys on the Yangtze River are tied to their boats. In the boy's hand was a rice cake. "Ooh!" cried the little boy. "Ooh!" cried the little duck. Quickly, the boy grabbed Ping and held him tight. "Quack, quack, quack!" cried Ping. "Ooh!" yelled the little boy. Ping and the boy made such a splashing and such a noise that the boy's father came running, and the boy's mother came running, and the boy's sister and brother came running, and they all looked over the edge of the boat at Ping and the boy splashing in the river of the Yangtze River. Then the boy's father and the mother pulled at the rope, which was tied to the barrel on the little boy's back. They pulled and they pulled, and up came Ping and the boy onto the houseboat. "Ah, a duck's dinner has come to us," said the boy's father. "I will cook him with rice at sunset tonight," said the boy's mother. But down came a basket all over Ping, and he could see no more of the boy or of the boat or of the sky or of the beautiful yellow water of the Yangtze River. All day long, Ping could see only the thin lines of sun which shone through the cracks in the basket, and Ping was very sad. After a long while, Ping heard the sound of oars and felt the jerk, jerk, jerk of the boat as it was rowed down the Yangtze River. Soon, the lines of sunshine faded. The basket was quickly lifted, and the little boy's hands were holding Ping. Quickly, quietly, the boy dropped Ping over the side of the boat, and Ping slipped into the water, the beautiful water of the Yangtze River. Ping looked, and there near the bank of the river was the wise-eyed boat, which was Ping's home. And Ping was his mother and his father and his aunts, all marching one by one over the little bridge. Swiftly, Ping turned and swam, paddling toward the shore. Now Ping could see his uncles marching one by one. Paddle, paddle. Ping hurried toward the shore. Ping saw his cousins marching one by one. Paddle, paddle. Ping neared the shore, but as Ping reached the shore, the last of Ping's 42 cousins marched over the bridge, and Ping knew he was late again. But up marched Ping, up over the little bridge, and spank! Came the spank on Ping's back. Then at last, Ping was back with his mother and his father and his two sisters and his three brothers and 11 aunts and 7 uncles and 42 cousins. And that's it. That's the end of the story about Ping. So, accepting punishment. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. What we're doing today is we're taking and trying, as we often do on the show, an experiment. This is where, you know, the ultimately one of the core purposes of almost all media is to change behavior for the better, for the world, individual behavior for the world. This show focusing on work, trying an experiment. Very often we have some of the brightest people in the world as guests here talking about work. And one wonders sometimes as I end the show, you know, maybe an interesting, but I wonder how much change accrues as a result. So it struck me that change often occurs from very simple things. And the example I'm liking to use on this show really is a bumper sticker, certain bumper stickers, like Do Random Acts of Kindness, which cost essentially nothing. And I like to think of it has changed consciousness in many people. So another example of simplicity in efforts to create change is children's stories. So I've read a couple. I've read The Cat in the Hat, and it's the dilemma it raises about how honest you should be, how much you should cover up, and inviting you, right now I'm inviting you to call in with your question about that if you're facing a dilemma about how honest to be, or maybe if you're a little uncomfortable sharing your own dilemma. You could certainly talk in third person, or a dilemma you felt has hurt others faced, or whatever. And then I read The Story of Ping, which is really a story about accepting responsibility. And it really is true in the workplace, certainly, as well as personally, how often people will externalize responsibility for their failings, blaming it on coworkers, bosses, capitalism, race, gender, sexual orientation, or whatever. And sometimes those are indeed factors, but not always. And so it raises the question about accepting responsibility. So what are your thoughts, either on the, especially as it relates to the workplace, on accepting responsibility versus, or about the wisdom or lack thereof of covering up at various times? Phone number here, Work with Martin Emko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. The next story I want to read is the very most memorable for me in all the stories I've read to my daughter. And in fact, even over the years, I've read some to adults because it is profound and really addresses one of the core issues, which is how much to sacrifice. How much to sacrifice in the workplace for the cause, if you're working for a nonprofit, how much to serve to because you really believe in the company's products, how much to sacrifice for some government agency and initiative that you believe in, and of course, personally, how much should you sacrifice for the one you love? That is The Giving Tree by Shel Silverstein. But before I read that, which I'm really looking forward to doing because I just love that book so much, I'd like to take a call. So I'll give out the phone number. If you have a comment, a question related to either of those two children's stories, ethical and other dilemmas that are raised in them, that is, how much should you lie, in, or a situation in which you're tempted to lie or have lied or you know somebody else has lied, in the workplace and the interesting ethical issue involved, or the issue of responsibility, externalizing versus taking responsibility, especially at work. Phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. How can I help? Or what's on your mind? Hi.
Hi. How are you doing there, Marty?
I'm well. I'm glad to have your call.
Yeah, I'm actually the astronomer who called some weeks ago, and you called. You said I was a charter member of the group, and
the Work with Marty Nemko workforce. I like to call it. Yes.
There you go. So I happen to be driving at the same time. So there's a number of issues, and I've only caught about the last few minutes that just got in the car. So I think there's two things you were sort of talking about. There was kindness, and then sort of the responsibility that one takes on for failings or success. So I want to address those briefly, each of them.
Please do.
The kindness, I think it's really important. It's come to me in recent years that really this issue of kindness or compassion, being able to empathy, being able to put yourself in another's shoes, is probably the most critical thing to me about any human being, how much you're able to do that. While at the same time, do have to hold other people accountable and responsible and all that. And that's why, for example, I do look up to President Obama. I don't agree with all he does, but I can see that he is able to do that, to take that shift. And it's very much, I think it goes back to the golden rule also, right? Do unto others as you would have done unto you. And it's just that, and so often we don't have that in this society. It's just like, well, you know, hey, I got mine, and that's what counts. And there's just this incredible lack of awareness that, you know, you were born with certain advantages, and you were able to, you know, maximize those and take advantage of those. But, you know, there are people who are advantaged, so...
I got it. Let me interrupt. Let me kind of keep things a little moving along here. There is some nuance required, however. You know, very often kindness in, you know, when, for example, when I see some person in great pain, whether it be a child on some commercial where they're trying to get you to donate or whatever, of course, it's immediately, you know, one would say, of course, we need to be kind. We're privileged. We should give money, et cetera, et cetera. But often... the real kindness is not necessarily that short-term kindness or that kindness distributed to all that we meet, because it is a zero-sum game. There is only a certain amount of finance, for example, in terms of donating money to charity, and one needs to look at where will ultimately do the most good. And in fact, the ones we're most likely to hear about are the ones who spend the most on commercials and are not spending the most on helping people. So I think we need to resist the short-term reflex temptation to be equally kind in our both time and money resources to not what's right in front of us, but really thinking cosmically about what will do the most good in the long run, which is, for example, why my charity of choice. It's very easy, I mean, to embrace Bill Gates's approach to immunizing every kid in Africa. But one wonders whether that's like the equivalent of giving a person a fish rather than teaching him to fish. I am donating quite a bit of money in the service of helping relatively low-income, intellectually gifted kids, because their programs in the public schools have been completely eviscerated. These are the kids with the greatest potential to cure cancer, to become our ethical leaders in the nonprofit and profit sector, build our bridges, etc. And yet they're completely ignored in the zeitgeist of the era, so I am likely to make a bigger difference, even though people would say, how dare you? Gifted kids will do fine on their own. So is there not some legitimacy to being more selective about how we dispense our kindness in the workplace and outside?
Oh, completely. And I would, those are great examples. I would say, you know, I would use the word taste almost. You have to decide what you believe in. And you're right. Some charities are wasteful. These days, there's a charity navigator you can use. But, you know, I'm much more an environmentalist, so I will support those. I will give to some political causes. I want to take it back a step and say, I think that's great. Giving money is great. I have really appreciated, you know, before the president was inaugurated the first time, he went out to, it was a homeless shelter, and it was Martin Luther King Day, and he had his daughter serve, and he's done this a couple of times. He said, these girls are very, you know, privileged, clearly, but we are going to serve the people. I mean, that sort of direct, just, you know, going to the homeless and feeding the homeless, and that's just one example, but I really like this sort of, like, you know, again, we are lucky to be born where we are. And I can tell, you know, you clearly think about these things in a clear way, and that's great.
For the interest of time, did you want to give me the soundbite? You said you wanted to also talk about responsibility. Could you give me the soundbite reaction that you had on the issue of responsibility?
Yeah, this is quite interesting. I think this is true. We do have to take personal responsibility while at the same time acknowledging there are external forces that, again, give some people more advantage from the beginning and some not. But I think we have a society that too often shells off responsibility onto others, and we do need to definitely take it more upon ourselves from the get-go.
Yeah, that's precisely the balanced approach that I had said, and I'm glad you agree. And you continue to be an honored member of the Work with Marty Nemco workforce. Feel free to call back again.
Thank you.
All right, you take care. I'm going to take one more call before I go read the Giving Tree. So welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn in the air. What's on your mind?
Okay, here's a thought. Okay. It is okay to lie when the consequences for telling the truth outweigh the perceived transgression.
Nice abstraction. I agree. It kind of makes sense. So can you give me an example?
Well, at work, as someone who does admin work on a contract basis, I get into a lot of crazy office situations, and a lot of times they throw work at a temp who no one else wants to do,
right,
and can put some people in conflict. Anyway, if there's a small error or perceived as error, the consequences or blow up can outweigh a small mistake.
I can understand that.
And you'll see a lot of people, and it's an art with many people that I'm trying to learn, where they gracefully sidestep admitting the error and say the error is something in the system that happened, but they'll take care of it.
Yeah, what's really yucky, though, is when they place it on some other person, so they're making the other person who was not wrong at all take the hit. Rather than generally the system. I have had clients do that all the, you know, complain certainly about doing that being done to them all the time. Some other guy screws up. It was just yesterday. This is a guy who does training for a major corporation, and they train people who buy their software, and he feels he's doing a fantastic ethical job, and there's somebody else who's also in charge of the training, and the other one is screwing up and blames the quote good guy for the screw ups with the training.
I'll give you a really dumb example. So in a recruiting fair at a job fair where you're setting up a booth and table and literature and people are coming in to table it and talk to people, I forgot to bring umbrellas that were on the list of supplies. Well, it didn't rain that day, but I must have heard about it from two other people that I didn't follow instructions. I was like, are you kidding?
The shallowness. You know, it doesn't even have to be, you know, I think of an example. Let's say there's nothing that went wrong, but how many of us have been in workplaces where we think the system, the, you know, the process or whatever is stupid, and it really, there needs to be a smarter system of management, and it's totally wasteful. And yet, really, if you were to speak up honestly, the chances are greater that you would lose your job if you, you know, told your boss, our system is really stupid, we're redundant, it's inefficient, I can't believe we have this process, even if you said it tactfully. There's a greater chance that you'd lose your job than that they would change the system. That seems crazy to me, but it's true. Do you find that? I know you've worked, you know, obviously you've called many times at the show. In the various places you've worked, have you found that the risk of, for example, pointing out that the system is grossly inefficient, and you work for government mainly, you know,
I can give you an example in private business from, I know a lot of people, and some of them are highly placed people, and in one instance, and since the company doesn't exist, I can say their name,
sure,
Sharper Image.
Okay.
They were concerned about legal rulings that you've heard about at Starbucks where rank-and-file employees are labeled managers so they can get around paying overtime. So a friend who worked there, when they said, get all the names of people we're calling managers, you know, and let us know about that. And so she said, oh, you know what? The same problem with these people not really doing management functions also applies to everyone who's labeled an assistant manager. And she got a lot of heat for that, for bringing it up,
right,
and suggesting that, you know, the pool of the problem was much bigger than they initially,
right,
wanted to sort of encircle.
Right.
And, you know, so there was a damned if you do kind of situation by telling the truth and
difficult
seeing
situation,
the greater problem.
You know, it's almost any organization you're going to work for is going to have some either injustice or stupidity. You know, it's human nature. You know, the product is done is not as reliable as they say. The salespeople are pushing. Again, I know the same client I'm thinking about, he works for this company that makes very expensive enterprise software. And he admits that the software sucks compared to the competitor. And yet, for him to go to his boss and say, you know what, this software sucks, I'm not going to go train people on this software, it's crazy. And now they're asking him to even try to close deals. He would lose his job in a minute, and he's scared. The guy's 50 years old. He's afraid that he wouldn't find another job. It is, you know, every organization, it seems like it is so tough to be honest, especially if you're worrying about putting bread on the table. You agree with that?
Oh, yeah, yes, and even in the, it's funny because you, not to trigger a, you know, a greater topic here, but
sorry,
very extensive, interesting article in Vanity Fair, I think it was in May, the May issue, about Edward Snowden. He said that, no, I'm not an, you know, anarchist who doesn't believe things should be private. I really do think there are many things that should be private, but the problem is, I work with so many enthusiastic and good rank-and-file employees, but it's at the management level they get shut down, because the problem is the people who oversee us, who squelch us for bringing up things they don't want to be brought up.
You know what? I also think that's a little unfair. I think they're, you know, humans are humans, and people who get promoted to management are not done at random. They generally are smarter, hardworking, and yes, probably on average, at least as ethical. I've seen plenty of worker bees being unethical. How many BS sick days they take, how much stealing, how much putting in 3 hours of work and playing on the internet for, you know, half their day. So, you know, I think blame can go equally around. I don't like it's very politically correct to always blame management, but I think that's unfair. What I do and I can say is that whistleblowers, wherever they are, whether they're in management or at the bottom, you know, studies show that whistleblowers pay a huge price for their integrity. And that, of course, is sad, but it's also the reality of humankind. Anyway, I want to thank you a lot for the call.
Sure. Thank you.
You take care. Now, I would like to, as promised, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. We're trying a little experiment here. We're always trying to engender change in so much of the media, news media, or shows like this. But we often do it with complexity, you know, having really the world's best expert guests on who've written amazing books and whatever. But that may be sometimes the loss. We get overwhelmed by the content, and that keeps change from occurring. I just see here that a listener wants me to name the charity I donate to help poor bright kids. I don't have one. What I'm doing is my wife's a superintendent of schools in Napa County, and we're providing our private funds to provide various programs for low-income bright kids. For example, I funded something called Camp Think this summer, just directly through the Napa County schools, that the kids who would otherwise be bored, a camp that taught them thinking skills. So what the camp did was they took a theme, which was bullying, and created a comprehensive plan for how to better deal with bullying in the district, and they presented it to the district superintendent. So it was really a lot of thinking skills and research and whatever in a very practical context. I felt that was an outstanding use of my money. These are not super rich kids whose parents would have sent them to fancy camps. They're not kids who are very low achievers who are struggling with just to basically get by. These are kids with the potential to become to have big ripple effects in our society. So the message is, I invite you to, in your own local school district, not I used to be a school psychologist in Tiburon and Belvedere. I'm not saying there, but and not so much the very lowest income school districts, because frankly they get a ton of support from foundations, from state. The federal government has reallocated a tremendous amount of educational resources to low income schools. It is more the blue collar and middle class schools where the funding has been completely eviscerated for bright kids, especially in an era of No Child Left Behind and Common Core, where the emphasis is really on getting everybody to a basic minimum standard. I would look to a blue collar and lower middle class or middle class school district and speak to whoever it is that is their coordinator or a person in charge of their programs for what they call gifted and talented or advanced learners. They keep trying to avoid the word gifted as though there's any genetic component to giftedness. So whatever, sometimes they call them advanced learners. But speak to that person in a given district and say, what is an unmet need that would make a big difference to children, to those bright kids, either intellectually or socially? You know, emotional intelligence. I was always a very bright kid, but I was socially an idiot. And it would have been wonderful to have been taught a little more about how to develop emotional intelligence. That might have enabled me to be more successful, certainly earlier. So, you know, that's my recommendation. You know, big charities have big overhead, big administrations, big buildings, big marketing efforts, all of that stuff. And sometimes the best thing you can do is go direct. It's something I've also done. I really do think this is really worthy of your time, so I'm going to take one more minute to do this. I asked myself, I said, every time I give to a charity, I feel like it just goes into the black hole. I said, what's the problem here? It's the middleman. I'm donating to these public charities because it's tax deductible. But what if I said, to hell with that? I'm only saving 25% or whatever it is by donating. What if I made donations directly to the human beings who really need it? So I posted it all. I write for Psychology Today every day, psychologytoday.com. I wrote this blog post. I'll give away 100 to 500 bucks to anybody who emails me. No big proposals, none of this. I'll give away 100 to 500 bucks to anybody who writes to me. I was going to give up a total of 1,500 bucks. I'm allocating the 1,500 bucks to $100 to $500 donations to individuals for whom that 100 to 500 bucks would have a big ripple effect. So I'll give you an example of the two that stand on my mind. I ended up funding them, but I got 50 or 60 letters that were brief emails, no big proposals or stuff. But two that, you know, they weren't going to change the world, but they felt more useful than just giving it to another public charity. It was a woman in Florida. And thanks to the internet, you know, you get the access to the whole world. It's not just who's in front of you. Anyway, woman writes to me. She says her husband is a landscaper, but then his truck broke down and they spent all of their money to fix the truck. And then his lawnmower or his edger broke and he can't work now. And that they got two kids and she's not working and he's not working and they're scared. I said, I'll buy you an edger. So to make sure the money didn't get wasted on drugs or whatever, I said, where is the place you'd buy the edger? She mentioned the name of the place. I called the place. I said, I'd like to buy an edger. And I picked out a model that I went on the internet, just looked at the Amazon reviews, picked the model, and then, oh yeah, then she told me there was a model she liked better. So anyway, I bought that model. It was $300. I bought the model, and I say, it's for whatever her name, Mary Gonzalez, whatever it was, and she'll pick it up. Now, that felt like a great use of charity dollars. It took almost no time. It was clearly 100% was benefiting somebody who is not, I'm not just fishing, teaching them to eat, you know, giving them a meal. I'm enabling him to provide for his family, make a living, and pay taxes. That felt great. And also psychologically, it felt great. The other one is in Canada. This is a woman who wrote to me, and she said she teaches in a preschool, and they don't have a refrigerator in the classroom. And so they can't have refrigerated, like cold milk or whatever. I bought her one of those little refrigerators. Not a big one, you know, like, I don't know, 2 cubic feet or whatever. Cost me $200. Did the same thing. But there, I ordered on Amazon. They delivered it right to her school. That felt great. All those kids now were going to be able to get cold juice or cold milk or whatever. No overhead, no nothing. $200. Felt great. So I invite, you know, part of why we work, this show's about work and career. Part of why we work is to try to make the world better. And one of the ways we do that is we take some of our money and our time and we donate to charity. And I'm wondering whether we're letting the tail wag the dog when we you know, insist on, you know, tax deductibility, and therefore we donate mainly to private charity, to public charities that have this massive amount of inefficiency. Might you want to write a little blog post or send that, you know, on some ultra local in your neighborhood? You know, I'm a member of this thing called Rockridge Next Door, where everybody is, everything from recommending a plumber to say there's somebody strange looking walking around the neighborhood, what should we do? It's a wonderful little email community. And what if you wrote on that, or even placed an ad in your local newspaper? Maybe something, again, not for the rich, but in some blue collar to middle class area. Again, the low-income areas, that sometimes the problems are so profound that you can't make a difference with your fairly limited money. But there are this people lost in the middle, which is where my heart is, that I think where you, and mind is, where I think you can make the biggest difference. So place an ad in a little newspaper or a Craigslist ad for free, you know, something like that, and then give some money away that you can afford. It may make a bigger difference, and it feels really good. All right, I digress. So now, the purpose of today's show is trying to offer lessons that exist, lessons for our work lives that exist in children's books. And now my favorite of them all. This is called The Giving Tree by Shel Silverstein. And it's about a tree who loved a boy and gave the boy everything he could. And then finally, as an old man, the boy, quote unquote, because it follows the boy through his lifetime, said, he was tired, and he asked the tree for a place to sit. And the tree told him, the tree said he would cut off his trunk. No, the tree told the boy, that's right, to cut off the tree's trunk, essentially murder him, so that the boy could sit on the stump, and the boy did the ultimate sacrifice. So the book embeds the question, how much sacrifice is to be admired? when do we admire a soldier who gives his life in battle? And I do say him because only men are allowed to serve in direct combat, and 99% of the deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan were to men. How about a person who works him or herself into an early grave trying to provide more income for his family? So that's the work subtextual question of the Giving Tree. And now, for the pleasure of it, as well as to make more concrete the lesson, it is now my pleasure to read you The Giving Tree. Once there was a tree, and she loved a little boy. And every day the boy would come, and he would gather her leaves and make them into crowns and play king of the forest. The boy would climb up her trunk and swing from her branches, and when he was tired, he would sleep in her shade. And the boy loved the tree very much, and the tree was happy. But time went by, and the boy grew older, and the tree was often alone. Then one day, the boy came to the tree, and the tree said, "Come, boy, come and climb up my trunk and swing from my branches and eat apples and play in my shade and be happy."
"I'm too big to climb and play," said the boy. "I want to buy things and have fun. I want some money. Can you give me some money?"
"I'm sorry," said the tree, "but I have no money. I have only leaves and apples.
Take my apples, boy, and sell them in the city. Then you'll have money and you'll be happy."
And so the boy climbed up the tree and gathered her apples and carried them away, and the tree was happy. But the boy stayed away for a long time, and the tree was sad. And then one day, the boy came back, and the tree shook with joy. And she said, "Come, boy, come and climb up my trunk and swing from my branches and eat apples and play in my shade and be happy."
"I'm too busy to climb trees," said the boy. "I want a house to keep me warm," he said. "I want a wife and I want children, and so I need a house. Can you give me a house?"
"I have no house," said the tree. "The forest is my house. But you may cut off my branches and build a house. Then you'll be happy."
And so the boy cut off her branches and carried them away to build a house, and the tree was happy. But the boy stayed away for a long time, and the tree was sad. And when he came back, the tree was so happy she could hardly speak.
"Come, boy," she whispered, "come and play."
"I'm too old and sad to play," said the boy. "I want a boat that'll take me away from here. Can you give me a boat?"
"Cut down my trunk and make a boat," said the tree. "Then you can sail away and be happy."
And so the boy cut down her trunk and made a boat and sailed away. And the tree was happy, but not really. And after a long time, the boy came back again.
"I am sorry, boy," said the tree, "but I have nothing left to give you. My apples are gone."
"My teeth are too weak for apples," said the boy.
"My branches are gone. You can't swing on them."
"I'm too old to swing on branches."
"My trunk is gone," said the tree. "You cannot climb."
"I'm too tired to climb," said the boy.
"I am sorry. I wish I could give you something, but I have nothing left. I'm just an old stump. I'm sorry."
"I don't need very much anymore. Just a quiet place to sit and rest. I'm very tired." "Well," said the tree, straightening herself up as much as she could, "well, an old stump is good for sitting and resting. Come, boy, sit down and rest." And the tree was happy. That is The Giving Tree by Shel Silverstein. How much to sacrifice for work, for love, for society. What are your thoughts, especially about work? The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, if you'd like to comment on the question of sacrifice at work,
especially, but you can go beyond if you feel like it. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. There's certainly one more story that I would like to read to you. It's quite relevant. It's the story of a typical active boy whose parent tells him no again and again. And indeed, that is reflective of the real world. Boys are disciplined at school far more often than are girls and are put on a Ritalin leash 8 times as often. And beaten down teenage boys commit suicide at more than twice the rate of girls. That continues into adulthood. In fact, in old age, men commit suicide at 1,380% the rate of women. The following is a rare book that offers a sympathetic view of active boys and men relentlessly having their spirit crushed. And in today's workplace, that is so much about collaboration and teamwork and consensus, it really is that flies in the face of what is the spirit of the at least stereotypical male. Of course, no one wants men to be Neanderthals and running roughshod over people. But there are many men whom, in the privacy of my office, feel that their basic essence is squashed when competition is seen as evil, aggressiveness is seen as evil and not sufficiently collaborative. And this is one of the rare books that offers a sympathetic view of active boys and men relentlessly having their spirit crushed. As parents and teachers and in the media, we seem to consider boys and, frankly, men inferior as needing their essence changed. Is that any fairer than asking women to change their essence? This is a book called No David by David Shannon. David's mom always said, "No, David! No, David! No, David! No! Stop! No! No! Come back here, David! David, be quiet! Don't play with your food! That's enough, David! Go to your room. Settle down. Stop that this instant. Put your toys away. Not in the house, David. I said no, David. Davy, come here. Yes, David, I love you." Those are messages. We may say we love or respect a given worker, but when, whether it be a boy or a man in the workplace, and they are hearing no, no, no to their basic essence, it is dispiriting. So I invite you to ask yourself whether you are being gender fair in the workplace to men and women. Phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. If you have a question or comment related to any of the children's stories I've read, as I've mentioned for those of you just joining us, sometimes I think simplicity is more likely to engender change than complexity. We may be viewed as anti-intellectual for doing so, but it's a price that may be worth taking, at least on this experiment that we're doing today on Work with Marty Nemko. In any case, 415-841-4134 if you've got a question or comment. And again, I'm going to have to apologize. I've made the decision that it's more important to stay on this topic than to do what I promised now last week and now this week, which was to offer 10 questions about that will help you decide if you should retire. So let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. What's on your mind? Hello.
Hello, yes. Are you there?
Yeah.
Yes, hi. Anyway, I wanted to comment on your experiment with the giving away money directly to the people.
Right.
I was a public school teacher years ago. I had to get out of that. It just burnt me out. But what I experienced, and this was in an inner city school, not in this area, in another state, what I experienced over and over is much, much support coming to me, but it was not what I needed. So many books, programs, all kinds of things.
Right.
But they were not streamlined to what I needed. So just to hear what you were doing was so heartwarming because it was directly aimed at exactly what they needed.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring up that point of before just giving it to any, even a private entity, if it's the school thing, contacting the person in charge of that issue locally and say, what is the unmet need that will have the biggest ripple effect?
Yes. This was in the time of No Child Left Behind, so
right.
There was so much pressure, too.
Right.
So, you know, you had all these programs coming at you.
Exactly.
That didn't fit at all. And people would say,
exactly.
Well, how can you not defeating?
Exactly. You know,
it's not what I need, what we need.
Exactly. Well, and, you know, now it's Common Core is replacing No Child Left Behind,
yes.
And it's the same
yes.
idiocy where we're taking kids who can't add or can't make change from $10, and they're being asked to compute the area of the parabola in the fifth grade. It's just, I mean, you laugh, I laugh, and every teacher I know, I was a teacher in New York City and in Richmond, California. So, you know, I'm not just one of these, I may have a PhD, but I am not pie in the sky. And I look at that Common Core standards, and I know what kids are like, and I just think those are out-of-touch academic professors who have no idea at all about what kids need, nor do they care. Because if they care, before making their pious recommendations on curriculum, they would visit schools at least, but we don't do that.
And not only that, but it's law. It would be happening in the Congress. They would pass these great sweeping reforms that honestly were ridiculous for me.
Right.
One
of my great fantasies is to take the halls of Congress and also every education administrator and lock them in a big auditorium and give them the test that they're asking all 12th graders to answer. They would want to scurry like through the holes, or they would bang down the doors to get out because they would fail. It's education is just this. It literally. Oh, my wife's a superintendent of schools and one of an eminent, and yet education is the most absurd Alice in Wonderland enterprise.
Yes.
But I digress.
I know. I'm glad you're passionate about it. I mean, I had to get out of it, and I feel some guilt over that because I was passionate, but it burnt me out. I couldn't take it, and that's depressing right there.
Yep.
I don't know what has to happen with it, but it just heartwarmed me that you would target specifically what a person needs.
What is required in education is honesty. We make these stupid statements that are utterly untrue. All students can learn to high standards. The teacher is a paid professional. If only she did this. We've been saying that for 100 years. We've spent trillions of dollars with these empty, pious statements. Instead of acknowledging the reality that all of us are different, like some of us are taller, some of us are small. Mm-hmm. I think about my doggy Einstein. No matter what, Einstein could never be an aggressive pit bull kind of dog. No matter what. Einstein is intrinsically sweet. We need to acknowledge, just like I will always be intense, other people will be always laid back. We can't make this idiotic statement that everybody is equal. We're not equal. Mm-hmm. And real education celebrates real diversity, that one size does not fit all, and we provide programs that meet individual kids' strengths, weaknesses, interests, etc. Yeah. As long as we keep mouthing these mantras that everybody's the same, education will continue to fail.
Wow. You know, they are preserving that in this quote-unquote disabled population. I've noticed in the school systems that is still preserved, but the others that don't quite meet that cutoff of quote-unquote a disability are getting completely lost in the shuffle.
That's not true either. Disabled, the law of the land is mainstream. You take kids who have severe learning problems, and there's tremendous legal pressures and to put them in the regular class, which deprives all the other kids of their right to an education because it's impossible to meet the needs of a kid with extreme learning and or behavioral problems without taking tremendous time and effort from regular kids. And the amount of growth that real special needs kids has from having the role models is far smaller. So no, it is ubiquitous even in the education in special ed. But
well,
I digress.
I might differ with you on that. But anyway.
Yeah, anyway, I got to go. Show's over.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I promise, I said this before emptily, but I promise next week I'll do those 10 questions, and they really are useful for helping you decide you should retire. But in the meantime, my thanks to my border operator, Joanne Marr, and of course all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I'll do 3-minute workovers on callers. And Lewis Lynn, he is the author of Rise Among the Noise. It's a great book about what it really takes to be excellent in a job interview. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.